I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Angus Deaton was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics last week. The Nobel Committee cited his accomplishments, increasing our understanding of how individuals make choices about consumption and how that promotes welfare. His research, the committee said, has transformed the fields of microeconomics, macroeconomics, and development economics by focusing on measuring poverty and health. Angus Deaton was a guest on Radio Times a few years ago to talk about the connection between well-being, even happiness, and a country's economy. He was born in Scotland, has been teaching at Princeton University for more than 25 years, and joins us from the studios of Princeton University. Angus Deaton is the Dwight D. Eisenhower Professor of International Affairs, a professor of economics and international affairs in Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. And Professor Deaton, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Congratulations on your Nobel Prize. And have you come back down to Earth yet?
I'm floating.
Are you
still
floating?
Thank you. Yeah, it's nice to be here. It's partly there's so much going on. It's had very little time to think. And I think I've stopped pinching myself now. So, you know, I think it probably is true.
So it's used to people saying Angus Deaton, Nobel Prize winner. You're getting used to that?
That sort of thing. I look at my wife, Anne, occasionally, who's a colleague here in economics, and I say, I won the Nobel Prize.
And what does she say?
Yes, you did. Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
And we won't belabor this too much longer. Is there any data on award winners? You're kind of a data guy, known for that. In fact, in many ways, got this Nobel Prize for that. Is there data about award winners?
Well, there's a complete list of all the economics award winners. I remember, actually, I was just starting out in economics when Frisch and Tinbergen got the very first Nobel Prize. And my mentor at that time got a Nobel Prize in about 1984. So I've been aware of it for a long time. I think people have tried to look at whether Nobel laureates live longer, but I'm not sure anyone's really come up with a very convincing answer to that.
Tell us a little bit about your background. You were born in Scotland. The little that I know about your family, it sounds like your father had some struggles making a living. Do you think being born in Scotland at the time that you did has influenced you as an economist?
Oh, every way, yeah. I mean, I was shaped by being a boy in Edinburgh in the 40s and 50s, and it had a huge and enormously powerful influence on me, yeah.
How so?
Well, we certainly didn't have very much money. That was part of it. It was still a city where the trains came through the center of the city. So it's potentially a very beautiful city as it is now, but everything was covered in soot. And, you know, you would touch a wall and your hand came away grimy. It was also a very cold, wet place. But it was also a place where there was lots of potential escape to the outside world, at least not physically, but through literature, through the history of the place. Not far from my house. I mean, I lived at a time when kids were allowed, you know, even quite small kids were allowed to wander around cities by themselves.
I remember those days,
and, yeah. You know, there was a wonderful public library and for children, and then next to it, the National Library of Scotland, where I sort of graduated to. There's a wonderful museum, which is now, I think, the National Museum of Scotland, was called something else then. But, you know, it was everything. It was like all New York's museums wrapped together with sort of paintings and stuffed animals and Egyptology and all that sort of stuff. And Scotland, you know, had this rich history. With seaports, there's a big seaport in Edinburgh, in fact, more than one. And I would love to go there and see the ships and see the contact with the outside world. So I dreamed about the world from a very, very early age. And, of course, we Brits are very much into India. So India was always a sort of central part of that for me.
How about class? Did that influence you at all growing up? Class
differences? A bit, but class is different, I think, in Scotland from it is. You know, so rather than the sort of class differences, the classic ones, we just hated the English.
It was in the genes, essentially.
A bit of an exaggeration, yeah. And of course, my father was English and had come to Scotland, so that's not really true. But when I lived in the countryside in the south, there was, you know, one enormous landowner, the Earl of Dalkeith, who owned almost all of the land. And it did seem somehow that we were, you know, peasants on the land of the nobility.
So how did you get interested in economics then?
Oh, by accident. And like a lot of my life, I'm always looking for things. You know, my colleagues, my wife will certainly tell you I'm very fickle. So, you know, I work on something for a while and get bored and then move to something that's just sitting adjacent to it. And I think that's and that's been good for me. And it's maybe a bit derivative. You know, I didn't think up some amazing new thing all myself. But I've sort of moved from where I was to something else and then sort of picked at it until I find something that people didn't know before. So for me, I was a math student at Cambridge, or a maths student, as we would have called it then. And, you know, I'd been a mathematician in high school and was good at it, but I was good at it in a way that it gave me lots of time to do other things like play sports and do music and
things
like that.
Meaning you were really good at it.
Well, not really good at it, but, you know, good enough so that I could do it quickly. And I had lots of times for doing the things that were more fun. And when I got to Cambridge, that didn't really work anymore. And, you know, I could have do fun things or do math, and it wasn't really possible to do them both. So eventually, math and I parted company. And I remember saying to my tutor, well, if I don't do math, what on earth am I going to do? And he said, well, there's only one place for people like you. It's called economics.
Wow.
So I became an economist.
I love stories like that because, you know, so many, especially young people are told today, you know, figure out the age of 18 what you're going to do when you grow up. And that's
right.
A perfect example about why that doesn't necessarily work for most people probably.
That's right. I've always had a hard time with that question, and somehow I still have a hard time with that question.
When people ask
I mean, if there's a slight worm in this apple, as people keep saying to me, what a wonderful end to your career. You know, I don't think of it as the end. I think I have a lot of other things I want to do.
Oh, that's great. Well, let me ask you about some of the things that you have done, and one of them is to focus on consumption. And this, I guess, was early on in your career, such as it is. Why consumption? What were you interested in trying to understand?
Okay. Well, again, it's very similar to the story I just told you about the maths. I mean, I got this job as a research assistant in Cambridge. And there was a wonderful person there who became my mentor, a man called Richard Stone, who won the Nobel Prize in 1984. And who'd actually worked with Keynes and others in building the British National Accounts during the war. And he had always been interested in consumption. So I looked at the person that I wanted to be most like, and I thought, okay, I'll study that too. And he was very willing to have me work with him, and he befriended me very early on. I was never a student or you know, he made me feel like a full collaborator from the beginning. Mm. And so I started doing what I do, which is, you know, trying to tinker with things, trying to make things better and, you know, come up with something that worked better than what we had or that, you know, I could compute more easily or that I had better data for. And so I always think of what I'm doing as this sort of tinkering. But in the end, you know, you've got something that looks like this amazing new machine, and then the Nobel Committee comes along and says, look what you did. And I sort of think, okay, well, I started with a lot of stuff and a lot of other people had worked on it, and I sort of played with it, and maybe, you know, I made it gleam a little more or a little slicker. And almost everything I've done, whether it's development economics or poverty or inequality, has been I was working on something close by, good people were asking difficult questions. Sometimes impossible questions, but, you know, I've had a lot of contact over the years with the World Bank, and the World Bank's a terrific place because they have problems, real problems, and one of the dangers of an academic is that you finish up just doing what other academics do instead of trying to address bigger problems that people really care about. I try to do that.
Well, let me pick up on the consumption part, and I'm assuming what you're talking about is just literally how people spend money, what they spend money on. I mean, is it – I don't mean to in any way uncomplicate what you've been studying, but is that – it's sort of how people behave based on the kind of access to money that they have.
Yes. So that's exactly right. And it's one way I put it is it's sort of studying what makes people tick. And this is one particular dimension, which is how they spend their money. And how do they do as well for themselves as they can while spending that money? So that's part of it. Their well-being is, you know, part of the story. But it's also it's up to policy because a big thing that influences what they spend is the prices of things. And, you know, the prices of things can be altered by government policy, for example, by putting taxes on or subsidies or import duties and things like that. So there's a lot of practical policy issues which, like, the Congressional Budget Office needs to know, which is when you change prices, you know, how will things change? There's another part of that which is probably more important, which is, you know, part of consumption is what people don't consume. And what you don't consume, you save. And saving is, you know, the essence of what is going to protect you in your old age, for instance, when, you know, you can't work anymore or you don't want to work anymore.
Exactly.
And so you know, the saving consumption decision, as we think of it, has been a central issue in economics forever. And I spend a lot of time working on that, too.
Well, we are, as you well know, you know, a country that really depends on consumption. I think something like 70% of our economy is based on people buying things. Does that worry you if we're talking about consumption and saving?
Well, it's certainly been a problem in the past. I think we've been overcome with other things since the financial crisis. But, you know, one of the big puzzles was just how little Americans saved, whereas countries like China are saving an enormous share. And then that's a real worry for whether people will have enough to retire on, or if they do have enough to retire on, whether the government will be able to have a solvent Social Security scheme. And all those issues are to do with saving and consumption and spending.
And do you think we're almost up on a break here, but do you think an economy like the U.S. economy, that that's sort of the right way to do economics, which is really to rely largely on people buying things?
As opposed to what?
Well, maybe China. I don't know.
Well, the Chinese like to buy things too. And, you know, part of what's happening in China is their incomes are growing so fast that they can keep on buying what they want and buying more and more every year and still have a lot left over to save. So unfortunately, that option is not really open to America.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Angus Deaton. He just won the Nobel Prize in Economics and he's a professor at Princeton University at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, joining us in this portion of Radio Times to talk about his work, which raises a whole host of questions we're talking about as well. To join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Angus Deaton. He's a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, and last week was the recipient of the 2015 Nobel Prize in Economics. You had mentioned your wife, Anne Case, and I was doing a little bit of reading on a joint research project that you're doing, finding an increase in middle-aged mortality in the United States. Can you flesh that out for us? What are you finding?
Yeah, I mean, it's a horrible, horrible thing. And I think we almost fell off our chairs when we found it. And, you know, we didn't make this up or collect the data ourselves. I mean, these are official U.S. government data. So there has been this big rise in mortality of Americans in middle age. And it's only white Americans. It's not happening to African Americans or to Hispanics. It's not happening in any other rich country around the world. All those countries, you just see this mortality rate falling like it has for the last 30 or 40 years. And so one might ask what it is. Yeah. It turns out a lot of it is drug addiction. And people are dying of overdoses. They're dying of alcohol overdoses. They're dying of overdoses of illegal drugs like heroin. And they're dying of overdoses of prescription drugs like OxyContin, mm-hmm. for example. There's also been a huge increase in suicides in this age group. And a big increase is in people dying of liver disease or of cirrhosis of the liver. And it's accompanied by an epidemic of pain and morbidity that goes with the mortality. So it's a really terrifying thing.
Is it related, do you think, to the recession? And are we talking about white men and women?
White men and women. It can't be. I mean, I'm sure the recession didn't help, but right. This started from 1998, and it's been going on for at least 15 years now. So the recession can't have been the immediate cause of it. One possibility is that it's much more to do with the very slow economic growth that many of these people have experienced throughout their lives compared with, say, their parents. So these are people who in their 40s and 50s are discovering that their dreams of being richer than their parents are never going to happen. It's much worse among people who only have a high school degree or less. And much less severe, though you see some of it among people who have some college or college degrees.
I mean, it sounds like some kind of a public health crisis.
I think it is. And we calculate the number of people who died is a little less, but comparable to the number of people who died from HIV/AIDS. So, and yet this has had almost no attention. It's the drug addiction problem and the deaths from overdoses is pretty well understood. But the broader dimensions of it seem to have escaped a lot of public attention. We're very excited about this work and wish it were cheerier.
Well, indeed, but certainly very important. And hopefully someone in government somewhere will take a look at this and, I guess, do something with the data. And I guess as an economist that looks at data, that's what you want, right?
Very much so. We want just a lot more public attention to this and, you know, not think of it as purely a drug. I mean, we've been calling it an epidemic of despair. And, you know, that's a dramatic phrase to emphasize what we think. I mean, it's not something you would really back up with data. But there's a lot of bad stuff going on. I mean, there's a huge epidemic of lower back pain, for instance. And lower back pain is incredibly hard to deal with. Doctors are just not very good at dealing with it. And it's one of these things, if you have, there's often very little hope. I mean, people have been through the medical system every which way. They do Eastern medicine, Western medicine, and they still live with that pain. And pain is a very, very hard thing to live with.
Yes, it is. You look at data. I mean, that's part of what you do, and part of it is looking at the information that you get and then drawing your conclusions from that. But I'm thinking, especially if you're asking people about their own lives, people can sometimes be imperfect about that or not, you know, not totally understand the question. They might not be truthful or not. How do you weigh that? How do you gauge or deal with that?
Well, you always have to make allowances for that. So you're absolutely, absolutely right. And sometimes the data are very hard and there's not much doubt. Like if we sort of know whether someone's dead or alive. You know, that's not very controversial. And you and I talked once before about, you know, if you ask people how happy they are, there's a lot of questions about what that means and, you know, whether you'll get the same answer when you ask them tomorrow and so on. But a lot of what I do is try to triangulate things. So if you're suspicious of a number, you may have another version of that number from somewhere else. And you can sort of track them down and see if they match up or not. And in fact, some of the most difficult stuff I've worked on, difficult in the sense that I've no idea how to resolve it, are things like measuring poverty in India where, you know, you see this enormous rate of growth of GDP in India, which the Indians are justly very proud of. But at the same time, there's much less poverty reduction than you would expect given that enormous rate of growth. And you might say, okay, it's like the United States. All this money is going to the rich people and very little is going to the poor. But that's not true either. And what it is just huge statistical discrepancies. The numbers don't add up. And that's very frustrating.
You mentioned income inequality. Is that a real phenomenon here in the United States, the growing gap
Yes.
between the rich and the poor?
Yes. You can – one of the things that's sort of interesting is to watch the press. Of course, you can – there's no single concept of inequality. It's sort of – one metaphor I like to use is there's a very broad river of people's incomes in the national economy, and they're sort of more or less going along together, but some are going faster than other bits. And how much inequality you'll see, which is sort of gaps between people, will depend on just which part of the river you're looking at. So, you know, there's been a lot of right-left stuff with the left saying, look, this horrible increase in inequality among group X. And then on the right say, well, if you look at it this way, there's really been very little increase in inequality at all. But I think we're in a situation now where we know that there's a tremendous amount of widening of opening up of gaps between different groups of people. And that for me, I've thought about inequality my whole life, and it's just enormously encouraging that it's become a serious center of debate, which it really has not been.
Is income inequality, though, bad for a country? If we're talking about the United States, is it bad for this country to have such a divide?
Well, it's a bit like asking, is weather bad for a country, you know?
Well, it doesn't have to. We don't have to have this level of income inequality, do we?
I don't know. I mean, in what sense? I mean, if you say we don't have to, you'd have to give me a specific policy and then ask whether that policy is feasible.
So, well, like a tax policy, for instance, you know?
Absolutely. So there's no doubt about that. We could design a tax policy which would make that inequality much less. So you're talking about the sort of engineering feasibility, right. But do you think that's politically feasible?
Probably not.
So that's the sort of question I'm asking. I mean, do we have to have it? Well, given the way the country is right now, many of the policies that you would think might do better will be very difficult to implement. On the other hand, you know, there are good parts about inequality too, but I think I'm in line with what you implied, at least, that I think right now the dangers are from having too much, not from having too little.
What's the good side of income inequality since you raised it?
Well, in my book, The Great Escape, I talk about it's called Health, Wealth, and the Origins of Inequality. And one of the important origins of inequality is just the world becoming a better place. So, you know, perhaps the greatest example of this is when, you know, the mid-18th, 19th centuries, Northwest Europe, you had the Industrial Revolution, the Health Revolution that went with it, which increased life expectancy and per capita income in Britain and Holland and other countries in Northwest Europe and the United States. So, you know, it's hard to think that's a bad thing. That didn't hurt other people in the world. So, but it generated an enormous amount of inequality because this didn't happen in India, it didn't happen in Africa, it didn't happen in Latin America in the first instance. So, you know, and someone invents a new drug, maybe some people get it before other people, big amount of inequality. So that opening up of inequality is a consequence of progress, and we wouldn't want to choke off progress in order to stop there being any inequality.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Angus Deaton, our guest in this portion of Radio Times. He just won the Nobel Prize in Economics. He's a professor at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, and we are talking about some of his ideas and his theories and some of the data that he's been using as well. And again, to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Or you can just listen to us talk on the radio. Let me just quote from Dickens. And you have quoted I ran across this quote from you a number of times. This is from David Copperfield. The character of Mr. Micawber says, income, 20 shillings. Expenses, 19 shillings and sixpence. Result, happiness. Income, 20 shillings. Expenses, 20 shillings and sixpence. Result, misery. That's a quote that you have said a number of times. What is he saying, or what are you saying there?
Well, you didn't read what I wrote after that.
No, I didn't. But go ahead.
If I remember what I said after that, is the thing that's most striking about this is that it's nonsense.
Exactly. Right? So why is that nonsense?
Well, because, you know, no one people are not usually living hand to mouth like that. So, you know, if 1 week you spend a little over, the next week you can spend a little under. And, you know, one of them is not going to make you super miserable and the other one's not going to make you super happy. But there are two points on that I can follow up. The original point of that quote was to illustrate that a cutoff of a poverty line really doesn't make a whole much sense, because we say, you know, there's 700 million people in the world, according to the World Bank the other day, living on less than $1.90 a day. Well, what about the guys that are living on $1.91? We don't care about them anymore. And, you know, why is there this sudden cutoff? It doesn't really make any sense any more than Mr. McCauber's statement makes any sense. But, you know, I think other work, the work I did with Danny Kahneman, for example, shows that there is a sort of truth to there, that if you don't have enough money to do the things that make life worth living, then you are really going to be pretty miserable. Mm. And I don't think having a little more makes you really happy. But if you're worried about money all the time, I remember when I first had a job in London, and people would say to me, you know, let's go out for a pint, you know, for a beer in England. I would say, you know, I can't. I just don't have enough money. And I remember just being incredibly miserable, because it's, you know, spending time with friends, socializing, that are really the source of much of our joy in life. So there is a truth to the McCauber story.
Is there a cutoff? In fact, I think this came up the last time you were on the show. We were talking about well-being and the index well-being. Something like 70, to put a, you know, put a number on it, something like $75,000. That seems to be an income that people can be happy on, if I can use that word.
Yeah, or that's the income level that we calculated, that, you know, above that, it doesn't seem to make your life much better. And if you get much below that, you're in the I can't afford to come for a beer situation.
We have someone who's going to be joining us after we say goodbye to you. And it's about an interesting study looking at poverty among children. And it was a long-term study. And they found after about 4 years, some of the children being studied were on an Indian reservation. And the casino on that reservation began sending about $4,000 to each of the families. And what the study found was that the children really, in many ways, in demonstrable ways, were much better off. I mean, in things like agreeableness and doing better in school. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense to me. I mean, I think, you know, not having enough money as a child, especially in situations where your parents can't mediate that, you know, meaning if they can't give you a good time in spite of that. So you could imagine being a child and living in a household. I don't know anything about the study, so this is the way I would think about this. That if you're a child and your parents are griping, complaining, worrying about money every minute of the day. You know, and my parents were not like that, but, you know, you could imagine your parents would create an environment in which it was really an unhappy environment because of the lack of money. And then there would be parents who somehow would transcend that and make sure that the kids had a really good life without that. But it's clear that the lack of money is a real danger, a real risk factor, especially when you're little.
Let me get some callers in. We have, looks like Victor from Center City, Philadelphia. Hi, Victor. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Great show, and congratulations, Professor, on your Nobel. There's a great divide in economics today between the behavioralists like the Robert Shillers at Yale, a Nobel Fellow, Nobel Laureate, and Thayer at Chicago, and the econometricians like the late Dr. Lawrence Klein at the University of Pennsylvania, himself also a Nobel Laureate. I hope maybe you could put a little light on that. And there is a very good book review in today's Wall Street Journal, The Way American Corporations Avoid $130 billion in Taxes by Keeping It in Low-Tax Havens. How would you feel about a value-added tax that makes it difficult to avoid the tax you should be paying? You know, you're going to go to Switzerland and get your Mercedes. Appreciate your comments. Congratulations.
Thanks for calling to Radio Times. Yes, would that we Thanks could all go much. To Germany and get our Mercedes. But what do you think, Angus Deaton?
Well, I like the behavioral stuff. And I think it really has been a major force in economics for change. I mean, one of the things I really like about modern economics is, you know, if you go back 20 or 30 years, and, you know, the late Gary Becker was a great proponent of this, economics was trying to take over all the other social scientists. You know, we were sort of imperialists conquering everything. And I think what we're seeing now is sort of the revenge of the empire. And those subjects have come back and taken over us. And the behavioral economics is very much a long overdue of infusion of psychology back into economics. And, you know, economists have to work this out, and that's what they're doing. But there's really tremendous work going on inspired by that. And Danny Kahneman was an important proponent of that. So I think that's very exciting. I think a lot of it has to be worked out. You know, on the tax questions, sure. I don't know exactly that loophole, but this comes back to something you and I, Marty, were talking about before. Sometimes, you know, a lot of these exemptions are very well protected, you know, which means they're not in the public interest, or it's hard to make a case that they're in the public interest. But the people who are benefiting from them are very well-heeled and very politically connected, and so it's often very hard to get rid of them. I mean, the carried interest deduction is an example of that. And, you know, we have a lot of money in politics in this country, and it means that these things, and I'm not commenting on this specific one, the things that may well not be in the public interest are very difficult to change because our representatives are often not acting in the public interest.
Well, 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye, you just said that. I scribbled to myself. I wanted to ask, are you an optimist, though?
Yes. Not a blind optimist, which I think David Leonard called me in the New York Times.
But
I think there are bad times. There are always bad times ahead, and there have been great catastrophes in the last 100 years, even as the world got better. But I'm optimistic in the sense that I think the roots of recovery are always there and that will come out in the end. So I think in the end, the world will continue to get a better place, but I don't think it's going to be smooth.
Angus Deaton, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times. And again, congratulations on your Nobel Prize in Economics.
Thanks for having me on. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Us as well. Angus Deaton did win the Nobel Prize in Economics last week, and he's a professor at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. And we'll be talking about that study after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Well, from the Nobel Prize in Economics to a long-term study of poor children in North Carolina, the Great Smoky Mountains Study of Youth tracked 1,400 low-income children. About 25% of them lived on an Indian reservation. And about 4 years into the study, their parents began receiving money, about $4,000 a year, from a casino. The effects on the children were profound. Our guest, Randall Aki, has been looking into the data. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Public Policy and American Indian Studies at UCLA, co-author of a recent study, How Does Household Income Affect Child Personality, Traits, and Behavior? And Randall Aki, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And it's really fun to put you right after Angus Deaton after his Nobel Prize win.
Absolutely. I'm incredibly honored. Thank you for having me. This is the first time I've been interviewed with a Nobel Prize winner. So, yes, it's great.
That's great. No, here we go. I mean, this study, it really did catch our eye because the findings just seem so intriguing, but also the study itself so interesting as well. First of all, this is a long-term study. When did it begin? How far back does it go?
Sure. So this is a joint study with Emilia Simeonova, who's at Johns Hopkins University in the business school, who's an economist like myself, and two researchers at Duke University who've been collecting the data since really the early 90s, 1993. Jane Costello and Bill Copeland are among many other PIs that have been working on this for a long time. And the idea there was to really collect data on rural children who live in rural communities and their mental health over time, and it was intended to be longitudinal. So really the advent of the casino operations was sort of a, you know, fortuitous occurrence that wasn't planned by any means. And this bump up in household income was really sort of unforeseen, but allows, you know, from the social science perspective, a really nice natural experiment, if you will, in order to investigate the effect of an improvement in household income, an increase in household income.
And what did you find? And what did you find when you began to
exactly
measure this?
So this study really looks at the change in child behaviors and emotional disorders. As I said, the study was primarily intended to capture that, and my co-authors have published tremendous amounts on this already. And we are looking at the children's between ages 12 and 16, what we call sort of the big five personality traits, and we look at conscientiousness, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And what we find is that between ages 12 and 16, for the kids who live in the households that receive the higher income, relative to their counterparts, sort of the slightly older cohort of children who are unaffected by the change in household income, we find an improvement in their personality traits over this time period, because we have measures, the individual measures for the same child at multiple points in time, as well as being able to compare them to the non-Indian cohorts of children in the communities. So there's 11 counties that are looked at, and we find no comparable change for those cohorts of children as well. So it really sort of allows us to detect out the change in behavior. Sort of, there's a reduction in emotional and behavioral disorders symptoms, as well as on the other side, flip side of that is that we see an improvement in conscientiousness and agreeableness of children over time coming from these households.
So what does conscientiousness look like when you're measuring that? Uh-huh. What is that?
So conscientiousness is a measure that sort of, it's this tendency to be organized, responsible, and hardworking. And our measures in our survey, the GSMS, the Great Smoky Mountains Study of Youth, is not perfectly meant to measure that. So we have to sort of come up with an index, and we use things that where the parents are reporting on what the child is doing. So we know whether or not the parent reports the child, frequently lying, rule breaking, their impulsiveness, concentration difficulties, those sorts of things. And from that, we create an index that, is sort of allows us to look at conscientiousness. And we see sort of, for the same questions, that there's an improvement, so a reduction in lying, a reduction in rule breaking, those sorts of things.
You also looked at agreeableness, and I'm assuming that's just being, happier?
No, it's more sort of about cooperation and unselfish behaviors, right? Sort of how do you function in society? And you can see why these things matter. These things matter for, the classroom, such that, students are good in the classroom, conscientious, they're actually, working, but they're also, getting along with the teachers and their fellow students. And there's been a lot of work on this sort of in psychology and economics and sociology, and showing that these characteristics have a long-run payoff, both in terms of education, but also in terms of the labor force. So you can see how these two things are very reinforcing to one another, and that any measures of improvement on this, especially for relatively poor populations, may be beneficial.
Well, and I guess we're talking about families, making 20 some thousand dollars a year?
So approximately. So again, the intervention, the change in household income, really initiated in the mid 90s. We're talking about 20 years ago. So household incomes were lower then as well. And it's a rural population.
Right.
And we do. So just to be clear, we have the entire population in our survey. So we actually have people who are not in poverty. But in general, household incomes there, at the time, even at the maximum, they were around $60,000. So they really, for the affected households that were affected, the four additional $4,000 per year represents somewhere between a fifth to a fourth of their annual incomes. So they were generally between $20,000 to $25,000 on average.
So does that tell us that families that received, and it wasn't like a one-time thing, so I'm assuming every year they receive some amount of $4,000. Did that reduce then the stresses within the family? That I mean, on one hand, you could say that's a lot of money. On the other hand, you could say it's not a lot of money.
That's right, and that's exactly one of the big questions that everyone always had for us was that, well, you know, does this extra money mean, is the mechanism through which this money translates into better child outcomes because mom or dad, you know, steps out of the labor force? Well, $4,000 per year is a nice amount, but it's not enough to sort of deter mom and dad from working. So it's not, we don't think it has to do actually with the quantity of parental time that's spent with kids. We think it's more about the quality of parental time. And we have some actual data on that. We can actually see, because we have information before the casino happens and after the casino happens, on parental full-time employment, and we don't see that changing, you know, systematically or differentially across these households. So it looks like, you know, people are still employed at a consistent or constant rate. But what we do find is that parents report less fights both with their spouse as well as with their children after the casino payments, you know, kick in. So it does seem like, you know, although we can't say definitively, that it is something about the household environment that improves. Sort of parental time with kids are less, perhaps less stressful, and, you know, it results in better sort of choices and, you know, experiences with the kids.
Well, we know, and this is, I think, across probably all families, that fighting about money is one of the top things that families do or parents do.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this, you know, this $4,000, as we said, is not a lot of money, but it actually is in response to sort of, you know, basic living expenses, you know, rent and, you know, some basic necessities. It allows this, you know, sort of base amount that it covers some, you know, really important necessities. And, you know, if you look at other government programs that exist, you know, things like, you know, TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or SNAP, the Nutrition Assistance Program, those, you know, generally tend to be around that amount as well. So this is not an unusual amount for poor families. What is unique about this, so this is the big caveat in this, is that this payment was really seen as a permanent change in household income, because other American Indian tribal governments had been implementing this, you know, on other tribal government reservations and for their citizens. So this, you know, sort of there was sort of an experience and an expectation that this would be permanent, and it has been. It's been sort of an ongoing program that has persisted.
Well, we are talking about how $4,000 of additional income has changed the lives of families and children living in poverty, part of a long-term study that our guest has been looking at. Randall Akee, an assistant professor in the Department of Public Policy and American Indian Studies at UCLA. The study titled, How Does Household Income Affect Child Personality, Traits, and Behavior? And if you want to join the conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Randall, I'm assuming that someone could look at this and say, okay, well, let's give $4,000 to every poor family in this country, and we'll see some benefits in how their children perform in school and perhaps what happens to them after they graduate.
Well, not necessarily. The pre-existing conditions on this reservation, so it's the Eastern Band of Cherokee in North Carolina, and they also have really well, you know, sort of well constructed community and institutions. So they do have a base of you know, the right sort of institutions and inputs. So those things matter too, right? You can't just sort of throw money if there's you know, unsafe conditions, if there's, you know, other things aren't going right as well. So, I mean, we have to be clear that the conditions on the ground there were also ripe for the sort of what we see going on. So, you know, the base level existed there. It's you know, you can't sort of just throw one money at a problem and expect everything to get well. So it's a combination, right? It's a community event type thing that happened here. So I think one has to make that clear, that, you know, this isn't just sort of a panacea, but it is something that I think the real takeaway is that if people think poverty isn't a problem, we have some evidence to show that, yes, releasing the budget constraint, the household income constraint, does have some improving effects on children. That's the real takeaway.
And it also underscores just how important that parents and children have a good relationship with each other.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And, you know, and the parental relationships are, again, as you said, sort of, constrained potentially by monetary problems and problems that, cause stress in the household amongst spouses, but also between spouses and the generations, essentially. One of the things you talked about was inequality with Angus Deaton.
Yes.
One of the things we do find in this that's really interesting is that we find that the children who start out with the worst behavioral problems or the biggest lack of the big five personality traits are the ones who actually gain the most after the intervention. So we see that sort of, there's a catch-up that's happening. And so that serves to sort of reduce some of this inequality, at least on personality traits and behavioral disorders, so that the worst off are actually improving the most.
And is
so it helps to reduce it.
And is it?
Go ahead.
No, and I want to get a call or two on. Just
sure.
A quick question here: Does it make a difference to intervene early if the money came when the children were, let's say, 4, 5, or 6 versus 12, 13, 14?
So we can't say that because we have a fixed cohorts. It was children ages 9, 11, and 13 at the outset. So we don't have children younger than that. So really we can't do that comparison at this stage, unfortunately. But we do know that adolescence still matters is the key. It's not just necessarily early intervention, but adolescent years can have an effect.
Let me see what Tim from Ardmore has to say. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, this is a really interesting study. Thanks. I had a question about the placebo effect this could have, whether or not the children knew that their family was receiving money. What I'm trying to get at is whether or not just the knowledge that they were being assisted might have had a factor in their improvement in life, or whether they, if they didn't know they were receiving any money, whether that would factor out the placebo effect.
Oh, that's interesting. Randall, did you look at that?
So I think, it's without fail that these households knew that they were receiving money because it was a pretty big deal for the community and everyone knew that this was happening. In terms of it having a long-term effect, one of the things we discuss is that we have the multiple cohorts of children. So we have slightly older American Indian children and slightly younger American Indian children. And we can actually difference out some of that community-wide effects that's sort of going on. And we think that's adequately controlled in this design, such that those sort of other sort of aspirational effects that are a result of this extra economic development and or program creation are really sort of netted out. So we don't think that's what's going on. But it's it's always a possibility. But I don't think, given our research design, that's driving what we're observing here, though.
And final question here. You did find an increase in what you call neuroticism. What is that and what did you find?
Well, it's as I said, we found an increase in a bunch of these personality traits, as I mentioned. And neuroticism is, it's part of the big five personality traits that are often measured. And it's this tendency to have a persistent negative attitude. And so we found a slight increase in that. And, it's based on these questions of feeling unloved or inferior to others. We find a slight increase. It's not gigantic, but it's still an increase on this dimension. And it's hard to make sense of this from our perspective in a real clinical sense because we are economists working on this project. It's not dramatically large, and we do find that the effects from conscientiousness and agreeableness, et cetera, tend to be larger. And then on the other side, the true clinical variables that we measure, which are behavioral disorders, emotional disorders, we do find those go down statistically significantly. So, I think it's just sort of in terms of being complete, we wanted to include as many as we possibly could of the big five personality traits. And so we do find some effects, but it's not driving everything, I don't think.
Well, Randall Akeed, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And he's an assistant professor in the Department of Public Policy and American Indian Studies at UCLA, co-author of a recent study, How Does Household Income Affect Child Personality Traits and Behavior? And we begin our conversation with Angus Deaton, winner of the 2015 Nobel Prize in Economics. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.